What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Fan Jackson. My guest today is an assistant professor of history at the College of Charleston. She has a fascinating article out in the journal Past and Present called A General Insurrection in the Countries with Slaves, the U.S. Civil War and the Origins of an Atlantic Revolution, 1861 to 1866. What it shows is shifts in policymaking in multiple places as a result of perceptions of global order change. So it's documenting this brilliant interplay of the U.S. Civil War, which in my own imagination kind of exists in a vacuum, with what at the time was seen as a radical revolutionary, I mean, it was a radical revolutionary movement in the Americas, which was the abolition of slavery. And the slavery question was implicated in, obviously, like the economic production and social orders of other countries. This is global power politics, man. This is what the show is about. And there was so much here that I didn't know. I really wanted to share it with the pod. Turns out we have friends in common. My guest, who the author of this research, is Dr. Samantha Lee Payne. Sam, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So there's disagreement among scholars about the extent to which the U.S. Civil War played a role in the abolition of slavery in Cuba and Brazil. Your article is intervening in that debate about, like, yeah, why Cuba and Brazil abolished slavery when they did. But obviously, I mean, nobody who listens to this is probably going to be familiar with that debate. Can you sketch out the broad contours of it just to set up?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing to kind of know about this is that both Cuba and Brazil, these are the last slaveholding societies in the hemisphere, and they implement legislation, gradual abolition legislation, that frees all children born to enslaved mothers in 1870 and 1871, respectively, right? Civil War ends in 1865. So there's an obvious kind of close chronological connection, yeah, that historians, this just jumps out to them. But it also goes deeper than that, because the very first historian of abolition, of Brazilian abolitionism, who was himself an abolitionist, says this is the reason we passed this legislation. He writes that in 1899. And so every 20th century historian then has to kind of deal with that claim, right? Like, okay, so what is the role of the Civil War in bringing about these laws? And so there have been really two kind of main schools of thought. One, in the 1870s, people like Robert Conrad, Robert Toplin, Arthur Corwin all say the Civil War is critical in elites choosing to pass these laws when they did, because suddenly slaveholders in Cuba or Brazil are isolated on the world stage, and they believe that everyone is going to view them as backward nations for maintaining unfree labor in the 19th century. Then another generation of historians comes along in the 80s, and this is people like Sidney Shalhoubi, Rebecca Scott, who all say, well, okay, that story doesn't actually include enslaved people in it at all. What was their role actually in bringing about the final destruction of slavery in the Americas? And they show, using all of these kind of incredible archival resources, that enslaved people were going to the courts and suing for freedom, especially for their children, in this moment. And they say, actually, these laws were the results of their efforts to claim freedom for the next generation.
Agency type argument, yeah.
Yeah. So it's essentially a kind of international events versus subaltern agency debate. And that debate has been kind of circular for a long time. There's been a recent effort to revive the old school claim that it was the Civil War. And that's generated a lot of controversy, especially in Brazil, because some of these scholars have said very explicitly in their work that enslaved people actually did not have a role in bringing about these laws. Yeah. So that's become a point of tension, I would say, among scholars.
Yes. This is very good context for understanding what you're weighing in on here. And your argument is like beautifully conjunctural. So you say the end of the Civil War precipitated the abolition of slavery in Cuba and Brazil because of the actions of the slaves. So
yes,
it's integrating these two perspectives in a sense.
Right.
Or it's like not denying either, but it's making a different contribution. So you have this great anecdote in the beginning of the article about Charles Sumner, mm-hmm. Brazilian ambassador to the U.S., talking to Sumner. Can you walk us through that anecdote? Because it was a great frame for understanding everything circa, I can't remember if it was 1861 or not, but like that early Civil War period.
Yeah, absolutely. So the article opens with this guy, Miguel Lisboa, who's the Brazilian ambassador to the U.S., and he goes to Charles Sumner in early July, before even the Battle of Bull Run has taken place in the U.S., because he's worried, you know, what are the implications of this war going to be for Brazil, the second largest slave society in the American hemisphere? And Sumner, of course, is this kind of larger than life figure in 19th century U.S. history. He's the most prominent abolitionist in Congress. He, a few years previously, was caned almost to death on the floor of the Senate. South Carolina congressman beat him over the back of the head for implying that his kinsman had raped or assaulted an enslaved woman. And Sumner was out of a commission for 3 years after that. And the Massachusetts Congress held that seat open in the Senate as a reminder of what violence he had suffered. But Sumner in 1861 is back in action. He's the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And so it's for that reason that Lisboa goes to him and he says, tell me, is this going to become a war for freedom? I need to know. Mm-hmm. And Sumner won't give him the reassurance that he wants. He's hoping no, right? He's, because Lincoln certainly hasn't pitched it that way.
Yeah.
But Sumner won't make the same commitment. And so what he says is, yeah, this could become a total war. This could become a war for emancipation. You need to worry.
Yeah, that's wild. So Brazil obviously feared a total war in the U.S. because total war would destroy the American South, and it was the destruction of the American South that offered like the highest possibility of abolition. Is that kind of the...
So they're afraid of it for that reason, but they're also afraid, and this is kind of what's in the background of my article, right, is the Haitian Revolution, because they know during this previous total war for abolition, revolutionary ideas of freedom circulated all over the Atlantic world, because enslaved people have geopolitical literacy. Mm-hmm. That's one of the central arguments of Isadora Mota and Julius Scott. Mm-hmm. They're reading these international events, and when they see a kind of transformation in world politics, they act. And so that's why Lisboa was so concerned, is like, does this mean we're going to face another kind of revolutionary wave of violence in Brazil, inspired by these events?
Yeah. Geopolitical literacy is actually a very good phrase to capture what is so disturbing probably to ruling classes everywhere at all times. At the time of the U.S. Civil War, you mentioned there were only three slave societies in the Americas, U.S., Brazil, Cuba. What was the density of their slave populations respectively?
Yeah, so the U.S. is by far the largest slave society, 4 million enslaved people working on cotton plantations in 1860 when the war begins. This is millions more than there were at 1790 at the end of the American Revolution. So the slave population has grown dramatically. It also grew in Cuba and Brazil. So in Brazil, in 1860, there were about 1.5 million enslaved workers, mostly laboring on coffee plantations, but also in sugar. In Cuba, there are 400,000 working mostly on sugar plantations in the west of the island. There also, it is worth mentioning, there was a much smaller enslaved population in Puerto Rico at this moment, 40,000 enslaved workers there in the other kind of last Spanish colony in the Americas.
Okay. You say at one point in the introduction that, well, actually, I have the quote here. The beginning of Reconstruction in the United States transformed the political implications of slave rebellion across the Atlantic world. The fall of the Confederacy forced slave owners in Cuba and Brazil to confront the possibility of their violent destruction. So, like, why did white elites in these societies come around to the idea that abolishing slavery would be either good or necessary? even though obviously that really messes up their political economy, like it's a slave-based, you know, economic structure. What's going on there?
Yeah. So first, I think that first point can't really be overstated, right? Slavery is central. It is a bedrock of the economies of all of these nations. 80% of Cuban and Brazilian exports at this moment are slave-produced commodities. So this is huge. So to give this up is a tremendous shift, that they're, for them to even consider this is really radical. But there are, in my view, kind of two things that happen. One is that the Civil War, just as Lisbon was so afraid of, does inspire kind of revolutionary activity from below across the hemisphere. So in Brazil, there are 63 rebellions, many of which we have literal evidence that they were directly inspired by the U.S. Civil War, that are devastating plantations. There are more than 3,000 enslaved workers in rebellion in northern Brazil in 1865, when these people first start to think, okay, we need to pass some kind of legislation. We need to give these people some kind of concession. But what I think also convinces them, right, that they can't actually hold on any longer, that they need to make a change, is what happens in the U.S. And so once slavery is destroyed there, as happened after Haiti, all of these confederados or Confederate exiles begin to flee. So there's a mass refugee movement out of the South to these last slave societies. And these white slave owners are showing up on their doorsteps saying, our plantations were destroyed. We're coming here in fear. The U.S. government is now facilitating black rule in the South. The truth of that,
it's hyperbole or propaganda.
Right? Right. It's propaganda, but the fear is real, and the fear that it generates is very real to these people. And so when they go then and begin organizing, which they do in 1867, right after black people get the right to vote in the U.S. South, they decide in the Spanish government and the Brazilian government to start drafting gradual abolition legislation that they hope will appease enslaved people and try to diffuse these tensions that they're facing from below, because they don't want what happened in the U.S. South to happen to them.
So it's like a co-optation or a buffering. They're trying to secure subaltern political loyalty in a sense to foreclose on getting heads chopped off, but, you know, to put it crudely. And,
yeah, I think one way to think about this is Gramsci has a concept of passive revolution.
I was
going to
mention that, and I was like, should I mention Gramsci?
Yeah, no, but that's where that's the theoretical basis of what I'm talking about. And it's also worth saying it's really only successful in Brazil. In Cuba, they can actually get this legislation off the ground in time to prevent a revolution, which breaks out in 1868, is led largely by enslaved people who flee plantations and join the Cuban Liberation Army. So that begins a 10-year revolutionary war in Cuba. So in some sense, the passive revolution doesn't work there. In Brazil, that doesn't happen, partly because they are able to get this legislation passed, I think, before something more radical could take place.
Yeah. What did the slave-owning ruling classes in Brazil and Cuba fear more? Like slave insurrection as a contagion that spreads, or a future where the U.S. Army is this force that supports black insurrection? Or is it some hybrid answer?
Yeah. No, I think it's a great question. In my view, I think the first thing is the much more potent and enduring fear, right? This idea of revolutionary contagion. And I think that's a fear that lasts throughout the entire period of the long 19th century in some respects, because it begins with Haiti when this event, this destruction of a slave society that was so inconceivable to them before, becomes a material reality. And then you see it at every moment in the development of these slave societies where, you know, I was just reading with my students here, Thomas Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia. He's talking about deporting freed people in the early 19th century because he thinks these people would justly execute him in some sense, right? That is a real belief that they have, and yeah. that they have to reckon with and repress and do whatever they can to try, in some sense, to banish from their minds. Like, that's the great work that the slave owning class has to undertake. And what's also amazing, though, about it is this article is part of a larger book project that goes through the beginning of the 20th century. But even when you have clearly a moment in 1898 when the U.S. government is not going to support Black insurrection, right? They're in Cuba saying that Black people have to be excluded from democracy. So what happened in San Domingue doesn't happen in Cuba. That is a full century after the end of the Haitian Revolution, and they're still thinking about this, right?
Yeah.
They're so afraid of the possibility of this Black Atlantic Revolution, so to speak. So I think that fear, you have to, in order to understand the mindset of enslavers, you have to think about that fear.
It's wild how big of an imaginary this was in terms of, like, hope for one side and fear for the other. And it just loomed so obviously large. And yet, short of, you know, the literature itself, like the historical literature, this shit does not exist in our imaginations now, you know? Like,
right.
It's weird. I don't know what to say about that. It's just weird.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, in some sense, that's what makes teaching this so rewarding, is that, like, kids come into the college classroom and they're not Yeah. being taught this about Jefferson, right?
Yeah.
So it's a new thing for people always to try to reckon with that, but it's not good. And yeah. it's not necessarily even part of the kind of public growing discourse about Black history in this moment, you know, that happens with, like, the 1619 Project, mm-hmm. where you get this continuous story of racism
yeah.
over the centuries, but that doesn't necessarily give you the sense of these people who always feel like they're sitting on top of, in what they call, a volcano, right?
Yes, there's like something about 1619 also doesn't quite do justice to this, where it's like the powder right. keg that they're worried. You know, you're sitting, you know, you've built an unjust order, and you're like, oh shit, I hope the chickens don't come home to roost. You know, like you could yeah. never be free of anxiety when your kingdom is, like, built on shoddy ground.
Yeah. And it's this, there's always that struggle for recognition happening in this world, right? Mm-hmm. Where part of acknowledging Black humanity for slave owners requires them realizing that these people perhaps should justly be able to murder them in their sleep. Like, they don't really yeah. want to do that. But
yeah. No, I end up in conversations all the time. I live in New Zealand right now, and, like, the mm-hmm. indigenous Maori population, there's this similar dance where, like, government here and, like, liberal society, because it's, like, a pretty cosmopolitan place, they're constantly trying to figure out ways to, like, do greater justice to the indigenous population. But, like, they were here first, and we, you know, the whites took their land, basically. But they're trying to reconcile with, like, okay, how do we make this situation better for them, but how do we not give up fucking anything, you know, materially? And how do we not, like, they don't want to go to the uncomfortable logical conclusion of, like, they would be justified in taking all this shit back from us and throwing us out. And, like,
yeah.
that's the only real ultimate solution here, unless you can get them to change their imaginaries, you know?
Right.
It's disturbing. In international relations, I'm an IR scholar. Mm-hmm. You know, we try to pretend to be scientists a lot. We talk about, like, mechanisms through which causal processes, like contagion, mm-hmm. happen. You know, and abolition mm-hmm. proved to be a policy that went viral in a way. What was the imagined or the feared process of Black Atlantic Revolution? Actually, let me rephrase that. How would you describe the causal process of your argument? So the interplay mm-hmm. of, like, civil war, slave strategies, subaltern strategies, and then, like, government decisions by ruling classes. Like, these are, like, huge things that have to configure together in a certain way? Like, what is, how does that, how do you spell that out?
Yeah. I mean, I think this kind of moves actually pretty well from what I was saying previously, right? Is that in some sense, the causal force here is this fear that they have that's activated within this particular historical window.
Yeah.
And I think something kind of useful as a way to think about this, right, is that it wasn't possible for this set of events to happen at all times in history, right? It has to be in these certain junctures when a kind of window of possibility opens. And that's a phrase from Du Bois of thinking about these as moments when all of these different forces align in order to make this subaltern revolution a real possibility, right? And so the Civil War, I think, is one of those moments where structures in American economics and American politics collide, such as to give, to bring down this old order that had existed for so many years. And it's, enslaved people can perceive that. And so they can take advantage of that moment in order to act and then bring about a certain set of consequences that were not necessarily imaginable to anyone at the beginning of this conflict, but which are very, very real to them by the end of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it does. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That's clarifying. This case, this, again, like the language of social science, this case, history, story, whatever, was an example of how governments can see transnational civil society networks as like a threat if the ideas in those networks threaten ruling class interests, which is like, that makes enough sense. But the answer to seeing that threat, like how you answer that threat, it was not only doubling down on repression or Cold War or whatever. I mean, there was that element, but by 1865, the Brazilian ambassador talking to Charles Sumner, you kind of portray him as having like flipped, you know, it, or maybe for like purely instrumental reasons, but he says by 1865, if we do not prepare for emancipation now, we will expose our country to immeasurable evils. So like, what are these evils? I mean, head chopping, is that?
I mean, yeah, to some extent, yes. I mean, I think that's the other thing, right, is you can't imagine this outcome even late as the war, in the war as 1864, you can't think this was inevitable even then, right? Because another thing I talk about in the article is how up until that point, enslavers did what they'd been doing for many years, which was strengthen surveillance mechanisms of Black people, try to control the movement of Black people throughout the Atlantic world, try to deport agents of suspected insurrection and revolutionary ideas. And those are policies that they'd been building in place, again, since the Haitian Revolution, which they had good reason to believe would work. And there's even, you know, there's contingency around American politics in that moment where Lincoln could have lost that election, right? So they can look at that scene and say, oh, well, you know, this could still play out for us. It could still all be okay. The repression is working. But what I argue is that after that, right, after Lincoln wins again, after the 13th Amendment is passed, after Black people are enfranchised in 1867, and all of these slave owners begin to flee, that's when they really say, okay, this isn't working. We are still facing the same kind of pressure from below, from enslaved people. And now there's a new force on the world stage, which is the US government, that is now beholden to Black democratic power. If those things align, and people were telling them that they were going to align. And also very little known is that African Americans were also organizing for this, right? This is another sort of part of my larger project, but freed people in the U.S. start petitioning for a military invasion of Cuba to try to destroy slavery. And so they actually do want to try to turn this activist Reconstruction state outward to project that power into the Atlantic world and to bring about a more democratic international and world order. And so, again, that's so hard for us to imagine now, right? Because we know what happened at the end of Reconstruction. We know the kind of international order that emerges at the end of the 19th century is nothing like what they would have wanted or what they fought for. But the slave owners don't know that in 1867. They think this could be real. And so they need to find a different way suddenly to protect themselves and safeguard their own standing and political order to the extent that they can.
So around the turn of the century, like W.E.B. Du Bois would have been very alive to this idea that like African Americans were already organizing to project power out, to basically do military invasions to overthrow white supremacy elsewhere. Like that was in his consciousness as he's writing all this stuff, and including as he's like, because he was an early advocate for entry into World War One, or a temporary advocate, and then he obviously like recoiled. Right. Every sane person eventually recoiled from that position, but like that is a context for his advocacy there that like I don't know I had picked up on previously. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not a pacifist, but I'm of the view generally that like violence does not serve progressive or egalitarian ends very well. Like it's a it's a crude means to realize that kind of end. And like generally speaking, the effectiveness of a tactic kind of depends on the strategy, and the effectiveness of a strategy depends on like the vision and the goals of the strategy. And my general read on history, like sort of that comes from my general read on history as much as it comes from like a philosophy about violence, you know, like violence serves reactionary goals really well. It's not great for our side. Right. And so I have a hard two-part question here. One, do you have a view, a philosophical, historical, whatever, about the place of political violence in democratic struggle? Two, am I reading you right that insurrectionary violence here was extremely useful in achieving abolition?
Yes. I would say to that second question, definitively yes. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that these laws would have been passed if enslaved people hadn't undertaken
the a necessary condition, right?
Yeah, it was a necessary condition. I do think there are people who would push back on me on that, right? Who would say actually there were many nonviolent ways that these people pursued emancipation and freedom, and that's certainly true. Every avenue that they could, they would pursue. That said, again, these laws didn't happen until this violence happened, right? So I do think
you don't get the fear of contagion without the violence, right? I mean,
So there's, I guess I would read this history differently than you might, right? I would say actually violence is a necessary tool for democratic struggle. Mm-hmm. That's, in my view, certainly true during the U.S. Civil War and during slave emancipation more broadly. I think that's not to say people shouldn't try to work within the system when that's all that's available to them, or, you know, I'm not of that mind at all. But in these circumstances, I think it was necessary and productive for democracy.
Yeah, I have to marinate on this more. There's got to be some kind of like emendation to account for your historical accounting. The historical argument is hard to deny. You know what I mean? And it's it's pretty clear that there wasn't going to be no abolition any other way. So like, I have to figure out how to account for this in my own worldview.
I think it's also one way I kind of think about this, right, is that force is always behind the law.
Yeah.
Bring down a kind of unjust order requires you at some point to break the law. And it's usually in those moments where force comes to the forefront of the struggle.
Yeah. I'm going to have to think about this more. So what is your personal sense? This is beyond the article itself, I suppose, but what's your counsel about violence?
I haven't personally resorted to this myself.
I don't imagine. Yeah.
Just to clarify, but I wouldn't condemn people who do, I guess.
Yeah. It's the Chris Rock thing about O.J. Simpson. Like, I'm not saying it's okay, but I understand. You know, like,
I buy you a car. You gonna let another man drive around in my car? Are you out of your fucking mind? Shit. What? You better recognize. Now, I'm not saying he should have killed her, but I understand.
Maybe it right. is okay. I don't know.
I mean, yeah. And it's,
in this case,
think,
like.
Yeah, I think under the right circumstances, this is, yeah, this is what's called for.
Yeah. Yeah. It depends. It just depends. That's okay. So, you know, your article really surfaces how in this like historical moment of the 1860s, everybody, this was like the thing, there was like a emotional takeaway from this. In a sense, or like you put the reader in a way in the historical moment, there was an immersion that happens, which is like so great. Everybody felt a kind of radical possibility, and whether you read that as good or bad depends on your situation, you know, but everybody was there. That's the imaginary.
Yeah.
I guess this is like a parting counterfactual. Can you speculate a bit about what if the North ended the Civil War in a way where the South got to retain the practice of slavery? Like, what happens in Cuba and Brazil? How does the Atlantic Revolution, I mean, what happens there?
Yeah, I think it would have been a huge blow to the revolution across the Atlantic world. I think slavery would have lasted potentially into the 20th century, I guess is my feeling. Yeah. I mean, I think you can almost get a sense of this even from the way Northern anti-slavery Republicans are thinking about abolition at the beginning of the war, right? Like Lincoln is thinking of this as a system that'll be abolished in 1900.
Mm-hmm.
The way that shifts so fundamentally mm-hmm. in the span of a very short amount of time, right, is what I think imbues this sense of the Civil War as a really world-shattering event, right? And shattering not only in the U.S., but in Cuba and Brazil as well.
Yeah.
Although not in quite the same way, because they try to hold on as long as they can. That being said, it's also worth saying, because Brazilian slave owners succeeded in this kind of passive revolution, slavery endures there until 1888, right? That almost is the 20th century. So... yeah, this really, it's like, it wasn't that long ago.
Damn. Yeah, it sucks how necessary Civil War was if you take as a given that the world needs to abolish slavery. Like, there was no way around. It's hard to see how there would have been a way around it.
No.
Yeah.
And they, I mean, the other thing that's interesting about that, right, is that once the kind of political reunion between the North and South is happening mm-hmm. In the late 19th century, the U.S. ambassadors go to Brazil and they celebrate the fact that Brazil supposedly did this without violence. And they say, oh, like, if only this could have been us. If only Lincoln could have succeeded in postponing, you know, abolition for another 50 years, right? We would have yeah. avoided this kind of catastrophic violence, but that's because they've kind of already, they're already in the process of abandoning their more radical commitments to the sense that actually the system was evil and it needed to be violently destroyed.
All right. Well, that's all. This was so fascinating. The article is called General Insurrection in the Countries with Slaves, the U.S. Civil War and the Origins of an Atlantic Revolution, 1861 to 1866. The beginning of a great book. Samantha Payne, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. This is really fascinating. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.